Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Glad to be joined today by Texas Politics Project Research Director Josh Blank. 2 days after what has felt at times like the longest primary season in Texas history. Now, this is a subjective rather than an empirical judgment, but nonetheless.
Yeah, I was going to say, are there a lot of people
I don't think I'm the only one that feels that way. But
well, I mean, given all the journalists we talked to, I can tell you for a fact that there's not a journalist I've talked to who doesn't feel like this has been going on forever. And I mean, I certainly feel like, I'll say this, I can't imagine there are a lot of Texans out there who are like, damn, I wish this were still going on. I wish these guys were still fighting it out because this has been great, you know?
So, I was thinking of starting with a recap, but I don't know that we actually really need to do that. I mean, I think, you know, if you're listening, you know who the winners were. If we were to go just in quick order, you know, Paxton beats Cornyn by a lot, which we'll talk about. In the AG race, Mays Middleton beats Chip Roy. On the Democratic side in the AG race, Nathan Johnson beats Joe Jaworski by a pretty healthy margin as well. And in probably one of the, you know, one of the only close races here relative, you know, and it was close, Beau French edges out incumbent Wright in the Railroad Commission race. And then Vicki Goodwin wins easily in the lieutenant governor's runoff on the Democratic side. Not a lot of big surprises in the congressional and legislative races. One incumbent loses.
Yeah, I mean, Julie Johnson was kind of an incumbent too, I would say. I mean it's kind of confusing because
in the incumbent versus incumbent. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, I mean, and also you had Menifee and Green, and you know, they're both Menifee was less of a Green than incumbent, but he was less more of an incumbent in that district than Green was in a weird way. So that was the byproduct of the redistricting worked, if you just want to just jump to that for 1 second, which is that Julie Johnson, an incumbent, is removed from the House for Colin Allred, who wasn't the House before, in basically the same seat. Christian Menifee removes longtime incumbent Al Green. I mean, this was kind of the idea of all this. So to the extent that mission accomplished for the Republican redistricting, like, this was part of it. Part of it was getting more seats, but part of it was also putting these Democrats in these competitions against each other and with the expectation the reality that only one could emerge.
The asterisk on those incumbents largely won was the redistricting, that those were set up to be tough races for Democrats. So it went. So where to begin? I mean, we have to begin with the Senate race, and we can talk about that. I would ask, you know, you've probably been asked this, and I know I have, but were you surprised by the magnitude, the margin of the Paxton win?
You know, I want to be honest, right? So I'm trying to be really reflective on it. And I think, I think it's easy in the aftermath to say no. I think he was probably going to, I would say this. The reason Paxton was in this race was because he had an advantage, and there was an expectation that Cornyn was going to have a hard time. There's a reasonable rationale we talked about a lot that Paxton really has leaned into the types of voters who vote in Republican primaries and Republican runoffs. And so, you know, I would say, you know, if you said 55-45, I'd say, sure, you know. But you're getting up close to 65, you know, two-thirds. Like, that was a little surprising, but it's also the case that it's kind of hard to determine once Trump jumped in the way he did in the final, like in the 11th hour kind of during voting. Yeah. It's sort of hard to know exactly, you know, what to make of this, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I was, you know, about like you were saying, I was expecting something, and again, I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
because for all the reasons we've talked about in terms of composition of the electorate and timing and turnout and all that. I was expecting a comfortable Paxton win by this, but I would say I was, if not shocked, surprised by, you know, this being a 20-something point race.
Yeah, I mean,
put it this way. I thought that Cornyn would be able to at least spend his way to a bit of a more dignified exit than he ultimately got.
Yeah, I think, honestly, my real gut reaction to this was, you know, man, it's hard to pull in these runoffs, right? I mean, we've been talking about this all along. But I think one of the things is that, you know, if you had been looking at some of the polling that had been kind of, you know, more or less leaked, really, like aggressively, like intentionally leaked around this primary to kind of shape, you know, what people should expect. I think the margins were generally a little bit closer. I mean, Paxton was generally up in most of the polling that I saw. I
think the polling average was 10 or 11.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when you see that, you know, my basic thinking is like, yeah, but this is a runoff. It's a Republican runoff. You know, do we expect the actual electorate that shows up to skew more conservative than the sample they could produce with all the techniques that are available at our disposal?
Yeah.
Or do we think it would be a little bit more moderate's not the right word, but just say less conservative? And, you know, there's always a good bet that it's going to be more conservative than you may even think. And especially in these sorts of low turnout races, which it still is a low turnout race. And so, you know, the fact that the conservative vote kind of expanded in that space is not surprising, I guess. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when we think about it, when we talk about it that way, it triggers the, you know, my, you know, more airy fairy, more abstract view of all this in some ways, which is like, you know, I'm not sure what we mean by conservative anymore.
Well,
I mean,
I know what
we mean in a thumbnail sense, and I think it makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if we were to look at, you know, whatever, self-identified ideology and all that, it's certainly pretty, you know.
I would say, how about this?
It's definitely the case that whatever our conventional measures are, this electorate was expected to be more conservative and probably was. But I think we're also, I mean, you know, it's still swimming around in my head that what we mean by conservative is, and what people mean by conservative is probably shifting a bit in a way.
Yeah. What I should really say is it's probably filled with more people who have, you know, more commitments, political commitments, and more extreme political commitments. How about that? We don't have to say exactly what direction is or put a whole wrapper around it. But I think that probably is what I would say is what these electorates represent. And, you know, look, and Paxton has leaned into that. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, I've been sort of telling people, I think, you know, one of the big sort of, I don't know, bias in the hot takes, you know, right after this election has been that I think a lot of people are only focused on Paxton's, you know, liabilities in a lot of cases and only focused on Tallarico's strength. And we'll get to this. I think that's kind of why I think the Republican machine has just, you know, dumped the ads out immediately because this kind of has been the focus coming out of it. But it is really like important to acknowledge the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, Paxton has experience running statewide, tons of experience. You know, he knows how hard it is to campaign in Texas. He has now just, you know, exited a very, very difficult primary. And sure, he has baggage from that, but he also has a lot more experience than does Tallarico. And that's kind of the thing here. Yeah, Tallarico has shown that he can raise a lot of money. He's raised a lot of money in the last few days since Paxton, you know, claimed the nomination. He can earn some media, but that's not what campaigning in Texas is. Ultimately, it's going to be a grind that's going to be going on, obviously, as we can already see, for a long time. And, you know, I mean, everybody who's doing the whole kind of, is Texas going to turn blue now, the usual kind of dance that comes up. It's like, you know, and is Tallarico the vehicle? And my response to that is a big, big question mark here.
Yeah.
You know, is he the vehicle for this? We just don't know that.
Well, earlier in the day, I did this panel with, you know, the people we've been rounding up for that, Mark Jones, Cromer Jeffers, Brad Johnson, Harvey Kronberg. And one of the things that came up in that it didn't come up in these terms, but as you mentioned, the statewide advantage, something that's interesting to consider in that is that when Paxton has had image problems in the past, and was running for re-election in attorney general, which is part of what we assign as his one of his advantages in terms of having statewide.
Absolutely.
But at that point, he had the luxury of kind of laying low. That once he got out of the primary, you didn't really hear much. And this is true of a lot of attorney general candidates. It's not just Paxton. But I think it really served Paxton well and was deliberate that he was able to kind of lay low in those elections in a way that he's not going to be able to this time. And I don't think that obviates his, you know, the advantages you're talking about. But it is a factor that I kind of had not been in the top of my mind until this conversation I had this morning that, you know, Paxton can't really hide this time.
Yeah.
Now, well, he may not need to, and that's a separate question, but. You know, his experience, I got to put it this way. His experience of running statewide is definitely, you'd rather have that than not.
Yeah. I think, you know, and it speaks to the broader.
It's a different kind of election this time for him.
That's right. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how he plays it. I mean, I think one thing that, you know, if you just take a step back and try to just be, you know, a neutral observer, I would say, you know, he's handled this election pretty amazingly. I mean, people have asked it, you know, I've got a lot of, I don't know if you've gotten this question a lot, but I've gotten the question like, you know, what was the pivotal moment for you in the election or whatever, in this race in particular? And I always say, you know, I think the move to kind of try to pressure the Senate on the Save America Act, you know, it stalled Trump. It's a great demonstration of his fealty. And I mean, like, you know, we'll see what the history books say about, you know, did Trump already know he was going to support Paxton? Like, you know, and he was holding on to Cornyn's support in the Senate. That's a possibility. Or was this really just sort of a last minute thing? Did they see the data and then just say, no, forget it. Let's get it. Let's take some credit for this. I mean, we're just not going to know until, you know, the history comes around.
If ever.
Yeah. Well, that's true, if ever. But it also just, you know, speaks to the fact that, you know, Paxton is an adept politician. And I've been, you know, sort of, you know, talking to a lot of people of sort of trying to figure out the how does Paxton become the guy who fells, you know, this quintessential Reagan Republican four-term senator. And, you know, part of it is that, you know, his politicking is really good from what I can understand from people. Like his actual, you know, retail politicking is apparently extremely good. But the other side of it is that, you know, he's just, he's used the powers institutionally of his office. So, well, you're pointing out, like, he can lay low if he wants, but he can also go sue anybody anytime he wants and do a press release and have it be covered and generate the kind of attention that has so far served him aggressively well in the primary. And I was just thinking about how hard it is for John Cornyn to combat that. I mean, even as a quote-unquote incumbent, you're an incumbent in this institution that's like overwhelmingly maligned by everybody, right? You know, when you think, when people are saying, like, what, you know, the sort of big line that they kept using was like, well, what can you point to that John Cornyn has done for you, blah, blah, blah? And it's like, well, honestly, one of the, you know, biggest things he did, like just historically, recently, was move gun legislation forward, right? Like there after the Sutherland Springs shooting, that everybody kind of considers to be, in some ways, you know, one of his biggest betrayals that led to a lot of this talk about a primary challenge. But it also reflects the fact that you can't do this. You don't have that kind of power in the Senate to just make an action, drop a press release, and then say, here we go. But Paxton has just leaned into the use of the attorney general's office to just create his own, you know, political brand and persona that seems to kind of exist separately in a lot of ways, even probably from like Abbott. And I mean, they're not always on the same page on everything either. And so I just think, you know, it's easy to sort of look at Ken Paxton and sort of line up all of the, you know, the challenges that he faces, and they're real.
Yeah.
But I also think that, like, it's really easy to forget about the fact that, like, you know, this guy knows what he's doing.
Right. There are assets that go with those liabilities.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, let's just, you know, I mean, let's just talk about that a little bit. I mean, I think, because I think, you know, the dynamic that interests me on that is that on both the Republican and the Democratic side, and this is a, you know, sociologically informed kind of thought, but, you know, it seems like among political professionals and people that are, you know, the super engaged, there's been a little bit of, you know, illusions are dying hard, I think, on both sides, right?
Yeah.
And on the Republican side, I think the most characteristic part of that, which you're plugging into here, I think, really well, is, you know, the idea that, you know, surely our party cannot nominate Ken Paxton.
Right.
Right. I mean,
right. Yeah.
You know, and that's a little bit unfair to some people, but I think that's a, there's a real vibe about that. You know, and you know, look, I mean, if to the people out there,
Republicans are saying it. I get it
that there were somebody saying, oh no, I knew that, you know, from the position of a more traditional quote unquote Republican, that you might think, yeah, you know, well, of course we are because things are going to shit. You know, I know that attitude was out there.
Right.
But at the same time, I think there was a certain amount of like difficulty reconciling with the reality. And on the Democratic side, to kind of switch over to that a little bit, there's a certain sense of that with Tallarico, that because Tallarico could talk intelligently about Christian faith, mm-hmm. and in an informed way, that, you know, he could sustain, you know, a couple hours of Joe Rogan, but really he's pretty deep on this. He can sustain an infinite conversation about this complete with, you know, the receipts and the footnotes. But that ultimately led to a certain amount of faulty thinking among a lot of Democrats that was going to be enough to cement his, you know, moderate or crossover, you know, his moderate bona fides or his crossover appeal, you know, to Texas people of faith. And I think that is going to, you know, I could be wrong about this, but from what we're seeing right now, that really underestimated his liabilities.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that's right.
And I should say campaign liabilities. I think somebody already leaned on me on social media or some other irrelevant mm-hmm. place. But, you know, the idea that just because you can enter an informed debate about Christianity, that all Christians or many Christians that might be a little discontented around the edges are going to go, you know what, that's okay, but you're that's going to inoculate you against all the kind of attacks and the efforts to define Tallarico that we're seeing as we speak.
Well, I mean, the thing you described, like, almost, you know, perfectly encapsulates the stereotype, you know, of kind of the liberal intellectual Democrat being like, well, he's Christian, so it should be fine. And it's like,
right.
Yeah, as we were just kind of talking the other day, it's like, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of Christians out there.
Yes, and often coming from people that probably could not sustain discussion. People of a more decidedly secular bent, shall we say.
Yeah. Exactly. And we know that through the polling data. And that's the other thing about all this, too. I mean, I think I should just sort of point this out here is that, you know, polling on religion is very complicated. And we do it. Other people do it. It's going all the time. And there's questions in our survey about, you know, religious denominations, about, you know, sort of born
against
status.
Yeah, we actually have a lot.
we have a lot because we come from an academic background, and these are academically based questions that, you know, we can use and compare to other.
Yeah.
You know, basically other surveys and other sources, and just generally other people will actually use this because it's sort of unknown and understood. But however, that doesn't mean that there isn't debate about this stuff. And when it comes to measurement, I will just say, as just a quick, you know, wrapper for this, because we have to go into this.
Right.
Measuring faith is very complicated.
Right.
You know, we can talk about some behaviors, we can talk about some loose ideas, but when it comes down to sort of actually uncovering people's faith and how that aligns or doesn't with organized religion, even the organized religions that they identify with, there are very few one-to-one matches through all this. And so that's just to say, you know, it may seem like, well, Tallarico's a Christian. It's like, oh, okay. You know,
when we put together a blog post for this podcast, we'll put a couple of these, you know, Tallarico favorability numbers by some of our religious measures.
Oh yeah.
And
exactly.
Whatever, you know, however much we want to caveat that, you know, those measurements, and I obviously totally agree with you on that, the patterns are still pretty clear when you look at those cross tabs.
Right.
That, you know, biblical literalists are much less supportive of Tallarico than those who have a more secular view of the origins of the and applications of the Bible, for example.
Now, this does raise an interesting question because, I mean, we've already kind of brought this up, but I mean, you know, the Republican effort to define Tallarico has wasted, you know, literally like no time at all, just getting out there and trying to sort of put some negative ads at it. And some of this was already going on. I mean, I think after the first round of voting, some Republican groups.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. PACs were already softening them up.
Yeah. Part of that was for the good of the team. I mean, obviously, like, they, you know, coordinated PACs and just spent a ton of money eviscerating everybody. It's like, hey, let's remind Republicans what this is about. So that was going on. It's obviously, we've already seen the ads. I mean, the ads are being replayed like on cable news and stuff. So, I mean, they're yeah. you know, reverberating out beyond.
Well, you know, I thought the Tribune had a, you know, slight bit of, you know, media observation. I won't call it mm-hmm. criticism, but I mean, you know, the Tribune headline today that, you know, was trying to be the story about, I think it was Tribune. I just want to make sure. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
That, you know, about the personal nature of this and make it a good point that each campaign is in a race now to define the other by their
negatives. I'm curious to see where you go with this. That's good.
Well, but the headline was Talafrico versus Ken the Criminal, colon. You know, I'm not sure I'm down with putting those attack lines in a headline. Very minor observation, but.
Well, look, I mean, Jim, the reality is.
That story is right. And the reality it's talking about is, I think, utterly correct. But I
don't know. I'm a little bit more suspect. I mean, you know, we saw something from a CNN clip where they were kind of going through some of this stuff. They used some more data, yeah, which is why, it's, you know, obviously that's all I care about now. Just kidding. But, you know, we're watching this. I'm watching this and they're showing these ads. And I mean, look, here's the thing I think, you know, we have to acknowledge here, which is that's a perfect headline for the Paxson campaign. I mean, you don't want your name, the criminal, put next to your name here. But to the extent that, like, all people are talking about is Ken Paxson's liabilities and his baggage, especially, again, in the aftermath of his nomination, if this becomes a race about, well, this is just a personal mudslinging battle and they both have, you know, baggage, well, that's a win. Straight up, that's a win for Paxson. Like, I mean, the fact that that's already the conversation is fabulous for them because
that elaborates my objection much better than I already have. I mean,
once I was curious about where you're going with it, but that's like,
I think the underlying dynamic and part of understanding, particularly, you know, part of understanding the outcome of the runoff mm-hmm. is that, as we've been saying for a few years now, for better or for worse, Paxson's liabilities are pretty baked in among his electorate.
Yeah.
You know, if you know who Ken Paxson is,
right,
you have some inkling of his liabilities and you've incorporated that.
Yeah.
It's not the same with Talarico.
Yeah.
Because Talarico is newer. I mean, it goes back to our who's run statewide and who hasn't.
Yeah, right. That's right.
So you're right. So I agree with you, and it's a better elaboration of what my seemingly kind of priggish objection to that. It is probably,
well,
thank you for giving me more substance to my priggish objection, but is that it does, you know, basically,
you're welcome, boss,
do work for the Talarico campaign or for the Paxson campaign that they would like done. And,
yeah,
you know, kind of is out of balance in that sense. And look, they don't have to be perfectly balanced. And I would, you know, this is a misdemeanor, not a felony. But it is going to, we're going to see a lot of this, as you say, by going to the CNN piece and all of that. It misses the asymmetry in this particular tactical battleground.
Right.
That, you know, it looks like a very new, it looks like kind of a nuanced analysis, but it's actually missing some important things, it seems to me.
Yeah. And so I think that's the first thing. And then I think the question becomes, and I mean, look, I'm willing to go into the details, like they're qualitatively different criticisms that are being leveled right now. I mean, one is like an oppo, one is a straight oppo research dump that's like, here's every, you know, seemingly crazy thing we can find that he said that we have a video of, whereas, you know, the Ken Paxson thing, I mean, just, and I, without even going down a list, I just say he was impeached by a Republican majority House for firing whistleblowers who have since been paid for being fired. Like, just set everything else aside. Like, I mean, there's a bunch of other stuff you could lead into or whatever, I don't care.
Right.
But just like, you know, there's the idea that these are just sort of, you know, he said, she says, it's one of these things, you know, it's like, and it is sort of the, and it is a very, you know, Trump era whataboutism. It's like, oh yeah. Now here's the overarching thing. Does this matter? And if so, how? I mean, to your point, you said like a lot of the stuff about Ken Paxson is, you know, likely baked in amongst people who know him. And I would say, I agree with that, but I'd also say, you know, baked in doesn't tell us whether it matters or not. Right. So for some people,
well,
it's baked in.
Or what circumstances it's going to matter or not. Right.
Right. And the thing is, the issue is that for, you know, most, what we would say is for most voters, their attitudes towards Ken Paxson are so overwhelmingly overdetermined, it doesn't matter. Like for Democrats who have strong Democratic views, like Paxson's, you know, ethical background is like just additional you know, whatever, right?
Right.
For Republicans who are, you know, dyed in the wool, you know, whatever, Second Amendment, they're anti-abortion, they're like fully in the fold. They voted for Ken Paxton before, they'll vote for him again. The reality of his ethical challenges are kind of like, whatever, that's faked it, you know, it doesn't matter. But the issue, I think, for Paxton we talk about is like, you know, yeah, but for those people who, you know, it matters in a different way, you know, for those Republicans for whom it's a challenge, that's the challenge for them, right? As we're talking about in a turnout. The flip side of this, just going on to the Tallarico thing, is like,
Where Tallarico and a headline helps.
That is where that helps to sort of, right, exactly. It's a sort of, to scare those voters into coming back.
Lest forget what the bigger picture is here now.
Right. Don't just sit out, come back. But the other thing I wonder about, and I mean, we'll just see how this plays out, and, you know, this will elaborate over time, so I don't want to spend too much time on this, but like, I just do wonder, you know, whether there's not some danger in trying to paint Tallarico negatively vis-a-vis, you know, opinions he's arrived at pretty directly from his faith, and that he's using the language of faith in order to advance.
Yeah.
I'm not like, you know, and I'm like, you know, I'm hesitant there. And I mean, I've seen the ads, like, I, you know, I get it, but there's like two things about them that seem to me to be risky. One, again, is that, you know, you're walking right up to his faith and almost making fun of him. And I think that's something you got to be pretty careful about in the Texas electorate, given what we've seen about the sensitivity of Christians to sort of being made fun of. Feeling persecuted. Yeah, exactly.
Or discriminated against, to use the precise language that we found in our polling.
Right. And so I think that's something that's just a little bit of a challenge. And the other one is more obvious, which is something we talk about all the time, which is, you know, in an election environment, which voters are consistently telling us that they have problems with the economy, that they're falling behind, that they're concerned about prices, gas prices, grocery prices, housing prices, healthcare costs, is calling Tallarico a freak and kind of making fun of him, which, and the tone of it is really interesting because it's a little bit different than some of the past elections so far. It's like, is that serious enough to meet the moment? We're at war right now, by the way. Like, is that serious enough to meet the moments that we find ourselves in, or does it align with the way the voters see the moment? And that's still something we're just going to have to wait and see. But I think it's, you know, it's pretty common to just say, look, you know, the Democratic candidate is the most liberal person who's ever walked the face of the earth. Their views are insanely out of touch with Texas. And so therefore, and obviously, you know, Tallarico makes that, they're kind of trying to do both. They're saying that a little bit, but they're also saying, you know, he believes this version of Christianity that's just so outside of the mainstream.
Yeah.
But the flip side of that, I'll just say one more piece of this, flip side is, does Paxton really want to have a debate with Tallarico over their faith?
Yeah.
I don't think
I think that is a trap that the Tallarico people are probably anticipating.
I think so.
And in terms of, you know, flip side and thinking about, you know, whatever, different branching, you know, possibilities in terms of anticipating the debate.
Yeah.
And maybe, and, you know, frankly, the literal debate.
Yeah.
Which I think we'll probably get at least one of.
I hope so. I mean, honestly, I usually don't.
No, I mean, yeah, usually it's kind of, at this time, I feel like this could tell voters something, put it that way. I don't want to chase too far down this rabbit hole because it's speculative. I guess you and I were talking about this differently. I guess I have a little more, I was going to say faith. You know, I mean, I kind of think that the Paxton campaign can make a mistake here along the lines that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. That they could stray into, wait, are they just making fun of him because he's a Christian? Mm-hmm. Which I think is kind of sums up what you see as the possible red line there reasonably fairly. You know, I just think they have a lot of room to run with that.
Yeah.
You know, because there's enough sectarian, you know, there's enough experience with sectarian Christian differences.
Yeah.
You know, I think of the experience of somebody very close to me who grew up in rural Texas who, you know, often dines out on the story of their kind of Baptist denomination throwing out a preacher and there being kind of a schism in this local small town church, you know, over the sermons being too long and people getting beat to the buffet by the other church.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of quibbling that goes on here that gets pretty serious without people, you know. But I mean, I think that's not wrong. I mean, I think your point is not wrong. It's just
I love that
story.
I think
they have a lot of space for that.
That's just a beautiful story because we'll move on. But it's like, oh, so you're saying that like earthly matters still matter.
Yeah, you know.
But, well, and also, also here in politics.
So, so I don't know. So let's follow up on some of that a little bit and back up. And I mean, you know, there are two big headlines kind of nationally and even locally, and I just kind of want to kick them both around.
Yeah.
Because I think both have some truth to them, but also are a little deceptive. Mm-hmm. The first is, you know, and it's not just this race, it's also what happened in Louisiana, a couple other places nationally. And that is, you know, this is pretty close to verbatim from the New York Times, Trump demonstrates tightened grip on GOP. And when you read that, I'm just wondering, like, I was kind of reflexively a little bit reticent to say that, even though there are parts of that that are obviously true.
It's funny because it's funny that you bring that up because honestly, I read that headline and I thought I took a pause.
Yeah.
And I kind of decided how much I want to intellectually engage with that. And I thought, okay, fair enough. Like I understand, right. You know, in the broad context that is a very reasonable headline to write. And it is at least no doubt. It's certainly true enough, right? Which is to say that, you know, regardless of what you think about whether or not Texas demonstrated a tightened grip on the GOP broadly, the reality of what happened in Texas in combination with the other races that we've seen before tightens his grip going forward with anybody else who has to consider a Republican primary at the very least.
Right.
So that's definitely true. I think the part that I was a little bit reticent about is the same one that you're a little bit reticent about, which is sort of like, you know, how do we describe, explain, measure would be lovely, but almost impossible, handicap Trump's role in these results? Because it's all over it, but I find myself having to caveat just sort of, you know, handing over the credit for it because there's other things going on here, right?
Yeah. I guess what I think of, you know, when I think of it's like fair enough, I think about, you know, discussions we've had and talking to other people about the, you know, the fact that certainly in Texas, you know, Trump's job approval rating still in, you know, low 80s, but the 80s.
Yep.
And kind of that's the comfort point for him across both administrations, more or less.
Yeah.
You know, where he settles after, you know, contextual surges, like, you know, right after the election, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty huge factor. Right. On the other hand, you know, that grip is tightest with the primary electorate, which in certainly in Texas and in most states is going to be much smaller than the overall electorate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I kept struggling for a metaphor that I still haven't figured out or, you know, he's got a grip on something, but it's something that's, you know, maybe shrinking a little bit. You know, or, you know, what does that tight grip, put it this way, that grip on the GOP means one thing in a primary election, but it's going to mean something entirely different in a general election. And it speaks to the dilemma that Republican candidates are going to have nationwide in an election in this structural point of the election trajectory, right? This midterm election, you know, where you've got a party in the White House and they're at a disadvantage. And what does that grip really mean in September and October? Now, we don't know.
Right.
But it doesn't mean the same thing it means now.
Yeah. Well, look, it doesn't mean the same thing it means now. And the real question is, you know, assuming as the electorate expands and his grip becomes less determinative of the outcomes, and we've been discussing it, the question becomes, what do these nominated Republicans do? Because, I mean, the one thing that's sort of, you know, so, I mean, one of the surprising things in some ways about the, you know, about the late endorsement of Paxton, right, to me, is that, you know, Trump created a vacuum, right? He said he was going to endorse, and he didn't endorse. And in that vacuum, the party, elected Republicans, largely in the Senate, and their donors and the class of people who are largely funding these elections said, you know, we are going to put our money on John Cornyn because we think he's a stronger general election candidate. That is the overt argument that they were making. They put $100+ million in, and then the voting starts and Trump says, I don't care, PACs. Now look, does that change the outcome? No, I don't think it changes the outcome at all. My read all along is he knew what the outcome was going to be with the data they had, and they said, okay, get some of this. But, you know, he didn't have to do that. And by doing it, he really makes clear to the elites who are actually running the campaigns and raising the money that he doesn't care, like, what their preferences are in this. It's only about his preferences, yeah, which he made very clear in the endorsement. It's about the loyalty to him and nothing else. So the question, you know, I think becomes, like, well, okay, the president has also said, like, you know, he doesn't really care about the midterms. He's not really thinking about, you know, people's personal finances. Like, you know, these are things that normally we would just say, you know, historically, well, that's political suicide. But he's not up for reelection. And so how does this, like, shake out? I mean, you know, to your point, yeah, like, I, you know, I mean, the thing that I keep kind of coming back to is in our last poll, it was almost 75% of independents disapprove of the job he's doing right now. 75. Yeah. Like, that's, like, out of bounds bad.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, and I mean, if you'd ask me right now, you know, can Republicans win in Texas with 80% support, 75% of independents against them, and 90+% of Democrats against them? I say, I don't know that they can. I mean, now, again, that's not the numbers. Everybody's doing a lot of simple back of the envelope math right now that I think is super sketchy. And I just want to throw that out there because everything's conditional on everything else. But, yeah, I mean, you know, the other thing I think is interesting to this is, you know, you go down the ballot, right? And so Trump endorses PACs and he has this huge victory. Obviously, he would like to take a lot of credit for that. And we were kind of talking about how much of that is Trump boosting PACs and how much of that is the bottom falling out of Cornyn. Because, like, there's sort of a what's the point here?
Right.
But also you had Mays Middleton win by about 10 points, again, against a candidate who had clearly had differences with the president, open differences.
Yeah.
In his case, kind of, it's unlike Cornyn, actually kind of leaned into it a little bit and said, hey, you know, you got an independent voice here. Mays Middleton spent a ton of money to make himself MAGA Mays Middleton. I mean, if anybody outside Texas knows who Middleton is, they, you know, the president say MAGA Mays, like, that's what it is. And he didn't have the same, you know, sort of expansive win. You know, you look at Beau French down there, the railroad commission race.
Right.
And this is the other piece of this,
which
right?
is the only close one.
Well, what's interesting about this one, just in the overall thing that
the major races, yeah,
that maybe, you know, you can react to a little bit, is that, you know, there's another piece of this, which you've got Trump on the one hand, you've got sort of Republican elites, I was talking about the Senate level on the other, but you've also got Republican elites in Texas, and the party, sort of the natural, you know, resource giving entities in Texas really aligned behind right, especially in the final weeks. I assume they saw bad data and really tried to push him with a ton of money, and it failed.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, your point, you said this earlier, you know, conservatism, what does that mean? But I'm thinking about the overall primary now that we're sitting here, and you think about, you know, the victories that, you know, Abbott and his, you know, his group were able to achieve. They were able to sort of move Sid Miller off. The ones they weren't, they've got Don Huffines on the ballot, right?
Yeah.
You know, you've got Beau French, clearly, you know, the elites in the party did not want on the ticket because of all the controversies, among other things. He's on the ticket. You've got, you know, Paxton and Cornyn, you know, again, the betting money was that Cornyn was the safer candidate. Well, you got Paxton on there now. And it's sort of like, so who's in control of what is actually a bigger question maybe than just even Trump's control on the slice of the Republican primary electorate.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of that is just a structural effect that we're, you know, honestly, I think we're going to need a political universe with Trump not in the White House to really figure out what the, you know, what the weight in front of the Trump factor is.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
We know it's heavy. We know it's heavy in a primary environment. There's no pussyfooting around that. You know, and our intermediate check-in on that will be the midterm, in which we see how Republican candidates at the statewide level in particular, or at the state level, I should say, navigate this dilemma, which, you know, simply put is, you know, you're going to have some incentives in a general election where you think you need some persuadable, you may think you need some persuadable voters to calibrate your closeness to Donald Trump.
Right.
You know, in response to an issue environment that is not in your favor.
Yeah.
And I just think, you know, obviously, as we keep saying, I don't think the particular math of that is going to become very reliably apparent before September anyway, probably.
Yeah.
Maybe August. Yeah. But in the meantime, you know, that's an uncomfortable position to be in. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that does feed back on the why, you know, if you're a Republican right now, you want this election to be about a couple of things. You want it to be about James Tallarico and his ideological profile as Republicans define it. Mm-hmm. And you want it to be about something as yet undetermined that is not the national economy and not Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know, without yeah. complete, you know, keeping that other consideration in mind that, you know, you can't, you know, you don't want to, nor can you renounce Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I've said this a couple of times as we've talked about it, I think, you know, what you want to find is a way to focus this on Texas, if you're yeah. a Texas candidate, to the exclusion of as much of the national stuff as possible.
Yeah, which is going to be a real challenge.
No, I think it is, unless, you know, the economy stages a miraculous recovery between now and then.
Yeah, which I mean, I think just given the structural stuff seems almost impossible.
Just seems very, yeah, very difficult. They could open the Strait of Hormuz tomorrow. And I think,
and still, it wouldn't,
you know, necessarily. It's not going to happen soon enough, and that's not going to happen anyway. So.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So, you know, what else? You know, in terms of, you know, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, you kind of brushed up against this.
Yeah.
Kind of the internal alignment. And it's still a little soon to talk about this. I kind of threw this mm-hmm. out there at the PAP thing and I got some response, but I mean, there's an interesting dynamic here. And I shouldn't say that. We got some response, but I don't want to poison the well here too much, but.
That's okay. I'll say anything. Go ahead.
But I mean, you know, look, I just had.
I'll try.
I just had Harvey Kronberg and Brad Johnson on the same panel. So there was a lot of range. But,
I was going to say something.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out here is, or, you know, what I'm mulling here is when this is all over.
Yeah.
In, you know, mid-November, and then we all are looking at January. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the impact and the sense of alignment in, you know, the 10 square blocks or 5 square blocks around the Texas Capitol? You know, because, you know, the odds on bet right now is that you're going to have two significant executive branch elected offices in the comptroller and the attorney general. Again, playing the odds, everybody should go out and vote for their candidate. But if it turns out that you've got Comptroller Huffines mm-hmm. and Attorney General Middleton, you've got two former state senators fairly closely aligned with, broadly speaking, the Patrick faction. And yeah. one of whom has, you know, kind of a borderline history of blood feud with the governor.
Yeah.
In the controller's office, should it come out that way. And possibly, I think, you know, in all likelihood, a somewhat smaller Republican caucus in the House.
Yeah, reasonably, you know, to expect.
Maybe by a couple, maybe by more, you know.
Yeah.
Depends on, again, what things start looking like. And, you know, what does this portend for the politics that we've seen in the last few sessions in terms of alignment between, you know, Patrick and Abbott, alignment between the House and the Senate, you know, who's got allies where in the, you know, who in the executive branch has allies where in the legislative branch. And I don't have an answer to that.
Yeah.
But I do think it's a pretty interesting dynamic if you're focused on legislative politics and what's going to happen starting next January.
I add to that list, you know, something just from before, which is, you know, without the unifying, because the unifying vector of Donald Trump over everything. I mean, he was a pretty big factor in the last legislative session to the extent that he acts as some kind of a, you know, unifier, guardrail, stick, carrot, whatever. You know,
he was, you know, a looming presence.
Yeah, a looming presence. But that if you remove that, you know, I mean, something that, you know, you already mentioned this, but it's kind of, it's really interesting to think about, because just as a, you know, as a, someone who's interested in political science and all this stuff, I mean, I think it's really interesting to think about what emerges in the post-Trump era in terms of sort of the ideological definition and makeup of both parties, honestly. I mean, it's not just the Republicans, it's actually both parties, 100%. And that's actually, you know, a really interesting thing, because to your point, you know, I think Ted Cruz probably has an idea. It might be different than his potential soon-to-be colleague, you know, in the Senate. And like, and I just don't know. And I think that's, I mean, I'm thinking to my, you know, you're talking, you're really talking about the agenda in a lot of ways, but I was thinking, you know, about some big areas where like there's, you know, I mean, property taxes is a huge area where there's a lot of disagreements amongst those groups about how
and
that
public should. And public disagreement between the governor, lieutenant governor, and the governor. And the governor has laid down some threats and red lines.
Yeah, I mean, the data center thing is I think, going to be huge, because they're spending so much money on politics right now, just the AI industry. Texas has this kind of, you know, mythical projection of itself or reality as this open, friendly place. You know, if you live here, I mean, we are in Austin, there are self-driving cars just going everywhere. I mean, constantly, like, you're building the data centers. But if you know anything about the history, I mean, the tax breaks those data centers are getting were considered, you know, say, the volume and the size of them were considered very problematic recently in other industries. Like, so I mean, so that's an open question. And so that's this sort of, you know, there's a local control. There's a bunch of stuff going on there. And it actually is going to have a lot of business interests and a lot of money going in various directions. I just, you know, who knows? So that's interesting. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff like that. And I mean, even so, Trump's still in the White House, so they can't really focus on immigration, and the border is like the scourge they have to, you know, essentially, you know, prioritize. So yeah, I, you know, it's a good question. I don't know what that's going to look like. As you said, the alignment internally is just so much.
Yeah, it's a little more opened up, I think. And I mean, I think what we're seeing is, you know, the exacerbating of familiar cross currents. I mean, none of this is particularly new, but I mean, I think, you know, it does have the potential to reshuffle the deck a little bit. And there's also the factor of, you know, so again, assume the highest probability outcome, both Dan Patrick and Greg Abbott are reelected. Mm-hmm. There's still a Republican majority in the House, but, and the Senate, of course, but, you know, the day after the election, you know, the speculation will be running rampant about whether this is the last term for both Paxton and Abbott. You know, they are not going to come out and announce that, but I'd be more surprised if those, each of those guys ran again than if they didn't.
Well, and so
there's an interesting lame duck dynamic there with two people in Middleton and Huffines that are probably not eyeballing finishing out their careers in the offices that they will be in should they win those races.
Yeah, that's really
interesting. Again, it makes my stomach hurt a little just to project out into the next election.
Right.
But I think, you know, if you're talking about the consequences here, this is one of them.
Yeah. No,
you know, one of the things to be, you know, and right now it's more like things to watch than it is anything we can know definitively right now. I mean, we're still...
Yeah, and I mean, and yeah, like, you know,
finally being through these primaries and having the runoffs done, we're at a little bit of a reset, or, you know, a threshold into the next phase.
Yeah, I think it's a good point to raise. I mean, I think, you know, the seams were already coming undone just a little bit, you know, even prior to all the primaries. You'd see these instances between Abbott and Paxton over, you know, who had the authority to kind of do what, especially around the quorum break. And that was really kind of an open, like, hey, this is my, and it was the first, it was one of the few times I actually seen them kind of openly just sort of say, hey, back off.
Even more recently on the, you know, one of the, you know, sort of anti-Islamic flare-ups, you know, so.
Yeah, and so they're you know, they're kind of shoulder reaching.
They're going to argue about that. They will argue about anything.
Right, exactly.
So what else? You know, you know, big picture. And, you know, again,
yeah,
I will issue our usual joint caveat about overinterpretation and then invite you to overinterpret. What is, you know, in this pause now, what do you, you know, what do you think about like where each of the parties is? I mean, look, on one hand, we know that both parties are kind of suffering in terms of general approval ratings.
Yeah.
You know, along with other institutions, you know, probably nobody more than Congress, which I think is an interesting kind of aspect of all this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, can we take anything from this? I mean, look, I mean, this goes back a little bit to the, you know, I said two headlines and, you know, we kind of went off on the Trump has a grip. The other headline that speaks to this, the point I want to talk about here is, you know, is this the moment of the definitive transition of the Republican Party from the, you know, and again, this is the overinterpretation part, from the party of John Cornyn to the party of Ken Paxton? Not that they are the leaders, you know, et cetera, but, you know, because on one hand, I mean, you and I wrote a couple of weeks ago, hey, the obvious has been kind of staring us in the face here for a while.
Yeah.
Ken Paxton is a, you know, probably a better representation, not just of the far right of the party, but of the median voter maybe in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Maybe, right? We didn't put it that way. That's a little more committed than we were.
Yeah.
But that certainly, you know, Paxton channels the Republican Party circa 25, 26 a lot more than John Cornyn does.
Yeah.
You know, here, and then, you know, the issue of Tallarico and what, you know, where the Democrats are on this. I mean, nominated somebody in this kind of schizophrenic view that he's both, you know, a young new generation Democratic progressive and he's got crossover potential. So, you know, I mean, general kind of morning afterthoughts on where the parties are here.
You know, to you, the way you set that up, you know, I don't know that I'm ready to say that, you know, Ken Paxton is a sign of what comes next anymore than I'm ready to say that the Tallarico is, right? Or or anybody at this point, because I think it's so wild. But I will say, you know, a little bit less sexy. It is the death of the Reagan Republicans, right? Like the idea of like this certain quarter, like I think about McCall, I think about, you know, Cornyn, and you think about these guys who, you know, over the last couple of cycles have filtered out of the party. And some of that's generational, but it's also, you know, it's also honestly dispositional. You know, I mean, some of the things we think about, you know, the US's place in the international order and all that stuff is changing dramatically. And a lot of the people who are really held a different position on that stuff are either retiring or being, you know, pushed out of office. And so, you know, I don't know what comes next. And I don't know if Ken Paxton is the vehicle for that. I mean, I'm a little reticent to go that far, you know, and part of that just because I don't think that, I mean, we already talked about this, like, I just don't think that there's a real clear path right now for either party that I think is exactly clear, right, in terms of what, you know, the ideology looks like. And that's what I mean, one of the things I've been asked a lot, and we've sort of talked about this a little bit, is, you know, is this like a big anti-incumbency moment? And I'm like, well, look, you could say that, and this captures some of this, right? But to me, that's not it. It's like, yeah, there's some anti-incumbency because, look, being incumbent sucks. If you're part of Congress, you can't do anything. And you're really more engaged in partisan conflict than in actual policymaking. So you can't come back to your voters and say, hey, look what I did for you. You can say, hey, look at my tweet or look at, you know, my TikTok or see what I did to this guy. See how I owned fill in the blank, right? And that is what it is. But it's just not the sort of thing that makes an incumbent like ironclad, like a school or a, you know, a new water treatment plant or whatever it is that your constituents actually, you know, want and need. And so I think there's that challenge for all incumbents. There is a generational issue here. Like these guys are old. Cornyn's old. A lot of the people in the Democratic Party who are being pushed out are very old. And there is a generational change coming on. But the third piece of it is this exact thing, which is, but what is next? Like what is going to be the thing that's going to animate voters of the right leading party and voters of the left leading party in the 21st century right now? And it's kind of like, you know, and we already see these conflicts. Like I think the MAHA movement is an interesting where you see these sort of crossover kind of stuff. The foreign policy space is another situation where you've seen a lot of sort of crossing over in terms of sort of where the ideological lines are supposed to be.
Yeah, there's less there's less ideological, there's less partisan sorting on those issues.
And AI is going to, I think, you know, and I'm not like, I'm like the last person to be the AI is changing everything, as you know. But I do think there is an aspect to this where, you know, the reactions of business and labor to changes that come about in response to AI is going to create frictions on both sides. We're already seeing it. I mean, we're already seeing, yeah, like, sure. You know, if you're a Democrat who took, you know, like, if you're a Democrat who's a crypto money or data center money or whatever, it's like,
yeah,
it's like a question now whether they should be suspect. I mean, it's not clear whether Democrats are suspicious.
Yeah, we're seeing little peaks of that, the way that the crypto money thing became an issue in the Menifee right. Green congressional race.
Yeah, know? And I think on the right, I said this whole data center thing is interesting because it's like, you know, you're not like, just, you know, they're not trying to put a data, like we live in Austin because we work at the University of Texas. No one's trying to put a data center next to my house because it's too damn expensive. The real right. estate's too much, the taxes are too much. So they're putting it in the places where it's not, and those tend to be rural communities, those tend to be exurban, those tend to be places largely represented by Republicans, and this sort of broadly pro-business
growth,
you know, growth, yeah, mindset versus the realities of the Fed. You know, Texas does have limited resources. Sorry. We do have a limit on our water, we do have a limit on our energy. And so, you know, that's just the reality. And I don't think, you know, the Republicans don't have an answer to that yet either. So all of this is like very, I mean, look, just, it's very interesting so long as you're not scared by it all.
Yeah. You know? And look, I mean, there's a, you know, there's an inherent fear factor here that comes from change.
Well, anxiety. Anxiety is fear of the unknown. And to the extent that, like, we don't, I mean, look, nobody knows what's coming next in a lot of different spheres right now.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, really generational transformations going on. And I don't love to throw that out because everybody says that, well, this is the most important election that ever happened, blah, blah, blah. Everything's the most important thing ever. You're the most important person to ever live. Blah, 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 blah. But like, there's a lot going on in this moment, both, you know, politically, ideologically, the information environment, communications, work, you know, just, the list goes on and on. So, you know, not surprisingly, the politics is reflecting a little bit of that.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, I'm just curious to see as we get closer to where people are paying attention, there's going to be a lot of, you know, speaking to mobilized constituencies and attentive potential voters throughout the summer. And I'm curious to see where that is all going to land, because I think that, you know, the strategies of the two campaigns are, as of now, the two Senate campaigns and what the parties are going to do. I mean, you know, their choices seem to me at this moment, you know, in broad terms, relatively clear, right? You've got Republicans looking for an agenda that will mobilize their voters without alienating too many crossover voters. And, you know, I think Republicans are at this moment in the professional class, you know, mindful of the fact that they might have turnout challenges. And we talked about that, I think, in last week's podcast or the week before. And that's there. And so right now it's a, you know, there are two things going on. I mean, the security blanket, as we've said, and it's necessary, and it reflects the lessons of 2018, and that, you know, they kind of let better or work get out of the gate.
Yeah, they're not
oversimplified, right? And that's not happening this time.
No,
right?
Absolutely.
And so pretty, pretty clearly, anybody that's listening to this knows what I mean by that, probably. But, you know, look at the anti-Tallarico ads being run by the super PACs right now. And as you said earlier, that started months
ago. It's not even summer.
Right. And so that is pretty clear. That's the negative part of the campaign. I guess I'm still trying to figure out, and I think the Republicans are still trying to figure out where the positive part of that campaign is going to be. And not like the campaign has to have a positive tone per se, but, you know, you can't win just by defining and attacking the other guy. I think it's necessary at the Senate level. And it helps the Republican ticket overall if you can identify Democrats with this construction of Tallarico as, you know, all these negative things that they're throwing out there. But what is the proactive part? And I think one of the things that, you know, the comments you were just making about data centers and growth and all that is that, you know, there's a little bit of a problem with what has been the classic mobilizing pro positive messaging of most of the Abbott era, even reaching back into some of the Perry period, but certainly the Abbott era, which is, you know, Texas is on the move. We're growing, you know, whatever else is going on out there, we're good here. I'm curious to see how they are going to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying they don't have anything to work with. They can, you know, say, we lowered your property taxes and we're going to do more. We're going to see that. But I, you know, and again, I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's going to be an interesting space to be in. And the summer, I think, is going to be watching trial and error and trial balloons with that, which is very much in dumb, not dumb, but very much an insidery nerd kind of game. But I do think that's what we're going to see this summer.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there's going to be more, probably more trial balloons this summer than we're even used to seeing because of the challenges that Republicans are facing. You know, one national reporter posited something to me that I thought was interesting because I hadn't really thought about it this way. And she was saying, you know, did I think that the Save America Act and sort of voter integrity broadly would be an issue that PACs would carry into the general? And she was mentioning that, you know, being in Washington, like Trump talks about all the time, like it just gets dropped, like all over the place. He wants it. And, you know, I think it was, we already said, like, that's part of the reason that PACs is probably in this position, at least partially, was, you know, his latching onto that and saying that he would, you know, definitely be a fighter for that. And I was, you know, she said, you know, is that an issue he runs on in Texas in November? And I was thinking, you know, that's an interesting question. I told her that's a good question. And when you think about it, that would be a comfortable way for Paxton to pivot towards a more traditional Republican issue in the general that, you know, again, it might not, it's not talking about the economy, but it's talking about, you know, like, look,
21st century traditional. Yeah.
21st century traditional. Yeah. And he could say, look, hey, and like, he's going to the Senate. And this, to your point, I think there's something to point to, not sure, which is, you know, his agenda in terms of what the campaign looks like, and Abbott and Patrick and those guys at the state level are likely to look pretty different. I mean, Abbott and Patrick are going to want to insulate themselves from whatever's going on and say, hey, thank God we're not everybody else. I could see Paxton say, hey, you know, we're doing it right here in Texas. We've really been tackling this voter fraud problem. We've been making changes. And you know what? I got to go to the U.S. Senate to bring this to America so that our elections are safe, so we have real representation, which honestly, an election where the polls are going to show most likely overwhelming Democratic support and trial ballots, both individually and generically, you can see how that would be a solid mobilizing argument for Republicans to at least get their base to show up, which in Texas is the main thing that they're trying to do here at this point.
I also wonder, I mean, along those lines, if part of the fallout of the terms in which they are seeking to negatively define Tallarico out of the mainstream in terms of Texas cultural politics, which is kind of, you know, everything from, you know, he believes in six genders, quote unquote, to, you know, he has this kind of screwy brand of Christianity.
He's a vegan, for God's sakes.
Yeah, he's a vegan, and probably even more telling and interesting, you know, this assault on his masculinity, which is also
very interesting,
to be a whisper campaign about his gender identity and all of this, right?
Right.
You know, is that, how defining is that going to be of the in terms of the proactive part of the campaign? Are they going to let that sit and say, well, do you want this? Or do you want somebody who's going to, you know, kind of the argument you're making?
Yeah.
Or is, you know, you're sort of suggesting they might do, you know, and they'll do all of it, but how tightly are they going to bind their promotion of Paxton to the negative stereotypes? Are they going to use that, drive his negatives up, but then talk in more to kind of, you know, more traditional terms about, and I'm going to go to Washington and support the Republican agenda and, you know, bring some of the great stuff we've done in Texas to the country, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question about what the relationship is going to be between those two components.
Well, and I think,
and I don't know, but.
Well, and it's inherently challenging, but I think what you're also describing, you know, is, I mean, it's interesting. Look, this is something that, you know, people have been saying, have also, you know, so does this mean Texas is competitive? And the answer is, yeah, Texas is competitive. Like, there's no, you know, and part of this is what you're describing in a lot of ways is, you know, Paxton needs to figure out which needle to thread, given a difficult election environment, in order to maximize Republican turnout.
Right.
And I just was like, the idea that, like, you know, the goal here is a blowout, I don't, like, that's not the election we're looking at right now. But here the question is, can you get enough voters to show up to get you across the finish line alone with that? And I think that's going to be, you know, gearing a lot of past the campaign. I think the challenge in some ways is something I brought up before, which is, you know, is that going to work for everybody else on the ticket? You
well,
know, that,
right.
And that's going to be a little bit, I think their incentives are a little bit different. They don't have his baggage.
And this came up in the last PAP thing to give people credit, but I mean, I think it's out there, which is the, but I think the fallout of that is if Paxton takes a sort of every man for himself approach to this, right? Which is all I got to do is get over.
Right.
Right. If he just gets over, then that is going to have negative consequences down ballot. Right.
I mean, if
Paxton only wins, you know, say Paxton wins by the O'Rourke Cruz margin.
Yeah.
Well, you know.
Yeah, I guess
what
my question
lost a lot of, you know, lost a handful of seats that session. And it had, you know, to go back to our earlier discussion, that had consequences for the agenda in the 2019 legislature.
Yeah, I think, you know, gaming that out is complicated because the flip side of that is, you know, do you think in an election like that where PAC sneaks it out, I would suspect that Abbott is going to have a better margin for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
And so then the question becomes, what is the erosion point from? Where do we start? Do we start at PAC's number? Do we start at Abbott's number? Or, and also further, you know, I mean, really in some ways, the question becomes, even if we assume that, like, we're assuming a lot of things. Well, you assume PAC wins, we assume Abbott wins. Assuming that Abbott outperforms Paxton, which I think is a pretty safe assumption, how much of a drag on Abbott is Paxton, and therefore how much is that in drag on the overall margins going down? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and one of the things we know for sure is that, you know, the Paxton people are not going to be in charge of the Texas campaign.
Nope. Nope. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, as I've been, you know, trying to point national observers to, you really need to, you know, pay attention to what Greg Abbott has been doing, what the Abbott campaign has been doing, and pay attention to what they're doing during the summer if you can get anybody to talk to you.
Yeah, the thing I'm going to be watching there is, you know, how does Representative Inhofe convince donors that they're not just burning money by donating to her campaign? And I don't mean to be mean, but like Abbott's got so much money and he's so much more well-known and he can bury her. If he wanted to bury her today, he could bury her, but he would just raise her name ID. So he's not like,
well, and I think, you know, I mean, and it, you know, who knows, but an interesting dynamic about that is that it will be interesting to see, and this is one of those things that will be hard to actually find out, but what I would predict, given the history of relations between the principals here, is that there will be some subtle and some not so subtle appeal to donors by the Abbott folks going, look, if we're going to save what we got here, we're going to do it. You cannot rely on Ken Paxton, you know, to define what is going to happen in the Republican campaign in Texas. Obviously it's going to matter, but you know, you need to make sure that we get the money to do that. And I think, you know, that has two virtues. One, just as we always show, has the virtue of probably being true in the sense of who's got the more competent campaign organization from a partisan perspective, but also it plays on, you know, probably the Republican elite disappointment in the fact that it's Paxton and not Cornyn.
No, that's a brilliant observation. I'm gonna say one thing. I wanna ask you one more question, then we should wrap up probably. But you know, I think that's a great observation because, and that also speaks to the whole federal state campaign finance dynamic, right? Which is that, you know, donors who want to keep Texas red can only give directly to Paxton so much. They can do super PACs and do other things. But if you really want to make sure Texas stays red, it's a really great time for Abbott to go to those exact same donors who just wrote their $3,500 check and say, hey, why don't you write me a $350,000 check and I'll make sure this is cool.
Right.
And like that's, I mean, it's a great time for Abbott to be looking for investors because there are a lot of people out there who are going to be unsure that Paxton's the vehicle for this or that they want to just dump a bunch of money in there. And I think the other piece of this is that knowing that Abbott is likely to not have to spend a lot of money on his actual own direct campaign, that money just becomes
right.
spread out
throughout relative, the party. Relative to the money he will have.
Let me ask you one more question, and then I think we should wrap this up, which is, so, you know, you're the Paxton campaign.
Yeah.
You want Trump to come to Texas for you?
Yeah, I think you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You take it. That
I think
game,
I think the timing.
Yeah. Okay.
Is probably gonna matter. Mm-hmm. But at the end, you know, look, and again, if Trump's, put it this way, if Trump's numbers stay where they are among Republicans,
yeah,
you want Trump to come to Texas for you.
There you go.
What do you think? That could change, but.
Yeah, look, I mean, from my recollection, the last time he came to Texas during a close election, the data indicated that it was a net negative for Republicans. And his numbers were better then than they are now.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, there's sort of this question, you know, had Cornyn won, did he want Trump's endorsement? It's like, yeah, I mean, he'd take it, but like, he's not going to deny it. I mean, it just is what it is at that point. No. You know, but there's a difference between that and, you know, Trump coming and holding a big, beautiful rally in Tarrant County or whatever. You know, I think that that's a net negative for him, because I don't think that Paxton really needs that much help. I'll say this, Paxton will have help mobilize Republicans from Abbott and from the rest of the ticket in a way that I think Trump actually complicates for him. But we'll see. And I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that will be a judgment about where Trump's numbers are when that decision has to be made.
Yeah.
And what the dynamics are with Trump. I mean, they may not want him to come, and
Trump may
tell them they need him, and they may not actually have much of a choice about it. You know?
No. I keep thinking about the decision to go to war. It's like, and then what?
Yeah, but I do think, based on where we are right now, you know, this plugs into this conversation that's been going on. Mm-hmm. I think if Republicans are still perceiving an enthusiasm and turnout problem on their part,
yeah,
and Trump's numbers have not dropped below 80 among Republicans,
right,
they kind of got to roll the dice and have him come.
Yeah, and it is a roll of the dice.
Because look, the counter-mobilizing effect is the counter-mobilizing effect of Trump. And I don't think him, I think, put it this way, I think him coming, whatever, you know, to the extent that it might raise the bar in both the counter-mobilization and the mobilization, it's probably, given the predicates I talked about, still a net gain in mobilization.
Yeah.
Again, if depending on where Trump's numbers are in the ball.
There's so many things going through my head right now. I don't want to, this will be another podcast. I'll leave it. Interesting.
Yeah, when we get closer. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for being here, Josh.
Of course.
And for putting up with me being late. Thanks a lot to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin, who helped engineer remote recording today so I don't infect everybody around me with this chest cold. Most of all, thanks to all of you for listening. You'll find supporting data, much more on all of this on our website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. And if you're still listening and you're somebody kind of in the fold in Texas government and politics, I also want to remind you that we have an internship bulletin board. A lot of kids looking for internships now for the summer and for the fall. You can post your position at that site for free. The site gets hundreds of thousands of users a year. I can almost guarantee you that you will get some resumes and some good applicants. So please, if you go to texaspolitics.utexas.edu, click on internships, you'll find a link to a very easy to use form that reaches a lot of people. Conversely, you know, a young person who's looking for internships, point them to this resource. Again, not something you have to pay for. It's public service. So, University of Texas and the Department of Government here at UT Austin. So I would point you to that resource. So plug completed. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back soon with another Second Reading Podcast.
The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.